You are a market leader operating in a highly competitive industry where efficiency and tangible results are paramount. You have a small and dedicated marketing team focused on executing regular marketing communications that must deliver immediate, measurable outcomes. You need a marketing partner that can seamlessly collaborate with your team, ensuring swift and frictionless execution, all while achieving quantifiable results in real time. My name is Tyler Chisholm, and as the co-founder and CEO of Clear Motive Marketing, we can help. With over 15 years of working with clients exactly like you from across North America, we have the team, the skills, and the processes to deliver the marketing that matters to you. Reach out to me on LinkedIn or check out clearmotive.ca to learn more. Hello and a warm collisions YYC. Welcome to my guest this morning, Mr. Sean Stinson. How's it going, Sean?
Very good. It's good to be here, Tyler.
Awesome, man. Thanks for coming on Calgary Conspires. We know similar people, and they decided to conspire to put us on a call. So I'm really excited to learn a little bit more about Black Line Safety. I know of, and I've heard of, and I know a little bit, but I always feign ignorance. I find I learn a lot more when I do that. You are president and chief growth officer at Black Line. So give us a little bit, let us in the tent. What do you guys do? What problems do you solve in the world? And let's go from there.
Yeah. So Black Line has been around for just over 20 years now. Black Line started as a company doing cloud connected GPS monitoring. 20 years ago, GPS wasn't as prevalent as it is now. So the company started out making things that tracked cars, for consumers. They were sold in Future Shop at the time. Future Shop still existed. They were sold in London Drugs. And these were car trackers. And it was a really interesting market for the business. But, about maybe 12 years ago, the company started to pivot into industrial safety. So Brendan Cook was the founder of Black Line Safety. A gentleman named Cody Slater came into the fold as an investor. And Cody decided to pivot the company into industrial safety. So since maybe 2013, 2014, the company's been a real player on the global stage. We started out making lone worker devices. So for people that work in industrial environments, you know, anyone wearing coveralls or safety boots or a hard hat at work, you know, that can become injured. What Blackline was doing was creating devices that are wearable devices that would call for help if they suffered an accident at work. And these are industrial grade products. So it's similar in principle to what you might see on TV, but these are hardened devices that work in every environment on multiple cell networks. Around 2017, we took another step again. We moved into the gas detection field. So we took what we had for connected safety and lone worker safety, and we added gas detection to it. And gas detection is a, you know, multiple billion-dollar a year market, portable gas detection. This is keeping people safe from atmospheric hazards like explosive gases, poisonous gases, toxic gases, oxygen deprivation. So things like carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, methane can explode. So we moved into keeping people, protecting them from those hazards. And through the connected nature of the product, one of the things the product will do is effectively call for help. So it's all cloud connected. There's cellular radios in the devices that we make. And, you know, we're competing against products that really haven't changed in 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. So the portable gas market was ripe for disruption. And when we took connected technology into it and allowed really fast reactive safety and proactive safety, looking at the data that comes from these devices, and allowing safety managers to keep better care of their workers by understanding the patterns of behavior, the patterns of usage. Why do some people get exposed to gas more than others? Why is it that in some types of infrastructure, people are exposed to gases? Our products can find leaks in industrial infrastructure because there's now this network of people moving around a facility and the units are detecting gas. So in terms of what problem do we solve, you know, we keep people safe. We have saved lives from heart attacks, from, catastrophic bodily harm, femoral arteries being cut, people falling off ladders, people being exposed to gas, explosions, fires, car accidents. So we really provide that rapid escalation of help to the right person at the right time.
Wow, so many. I have 1,000 questions. Which one do I start with? You did mention earlier, because you're a Calgary-based company, just for everybody listening on the phone, but you mentioned very quickly a global opportunity and a global footprint. And I think that maybe ties into the reason this certain individual connected us was you've also reached a milestone for the size of your company. So maybe just talk about where you guys have got to. Being Calgary, where's your reach? Are you literally truly, truly global? And I think you've hit the $100 million kind of hurdle or high bar, if you will, in terms of growth, just to give people listening a context of like who the scope and the scale of your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So Blackline today is just over 500 individuals. It's 500 people that are really, you know, believe in this mission of bringing connected safety into this market. And we are engineers, we're manufacturers, we're marketers, we're finance professionals, you know, salespeople, channel people. So we really built an entirely vertically integrated business that does everything from design and manufacture to international sales and marketing. And we take these products into, I think today we have product in, and we're a service provider as well. So this is a HeSaaS solution. So it's, it's devices you wear, but it's also the cloud native side of this. It's that all this data is coming to a cloud. So when I say product, I mean, it's the entire ecosystem. We deliver that into over 70 countries right now. We've got employees, I think, in 40 countries. Like I said, a little over 500 people globally. There's about 350 in Calgary. This is our headquarters. We design and manufacture primarily in Calgary. And just this last year, our fiscal year end is October 31st. So for fiscal 2023, we closed at $100 million. And that was a big milestone for
Congratulations.
Us.
Congratulations. That's no joke.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's, and I think we are one of the, you know, unique stories in Calgary from a tech perspective. We have a really, you know, great team here. We are a high tech business. A lot of us take a lot of pride that we've been able to build something like that here in Calgary.
I love it. You fit perfectly into my sweet spot of like often the stories, and not saying your story isn't well told, but so often if you don't work directly or have an interaction with an organization, you just don't know that it exists. Like, oh, Calgary needs more of this or needs more of that. I'm like, well, let's not forget to celebrate the things that are here as well, right? While we have that dialogue. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit at the balance between, you know, the HeSaaS, the hardware and the SaaS side of the business. Like so many companies I see now in the startup space of seemingly, I'm making my own broad statements, avoid anything hardware related. Oh, it's expensive and it's time consuming and investors don't want to play in that space. They're looking for that pure SaaS, big scale opportunity. But your business is both, is what I'm hearing loud and clear.
Yeah, exactly. So HeSaaS, for people that haven't heard that before, that's hardware-enabled software as a service. Other examples of HeSaaS are your cable box at home, like your Apple TV. Mm-hmm. You bought a piece of hardware and you are paying a subscription to Apple Plus or Disney Plus or whatever that's enabled through that hardware. Your cell phone is effectively hardware enabled SaaS. You buy a piece of hardware, but you're paying a service fee for that. And so it's a way of delivering value to people over time. It, from a business perspective, it is interesting. Like I guess this is maybe more for people that are in the like tech community, you know, entrepreneurs starting a company. If you get into hardware alone, there's a really high chance you become commoditized. You are building hardware, And it's you're building to a spec and 50 other people are building to that same spec, you can enter
race,
a price
race war. Becomes an arms race to the bottom, right?
Exactly. So you need to find a way to differentiate yourself, and hardware differentiation can be tricky over the long term because people can easily copy what you're doing. Now people can copy what we do as well. It's a bit harder because we have this combination of hardware and then value that is delivered largely through web.
The word enabled, I think, is really like I really hang it on that. Like one is enabling the power of the other, and together is the output, is the value proposition. It's not one or the other. The word enabled really resonated with me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's an absolutely true story. So from a business design perspective, I'd say like if you have a hardware enabled SaaS play, you have more of a moat because especially in our industry, you can't do gas detection in the cloud. You know, you need a piece of hardware on that person.
We still live in the real world, everybody. Like we still interact in physical, like it's still 3D. You know, I love the conceptual idea of Meta and all those things. But at the end of the day, people are working in environments that can kill them.
Exactly.
Just to be blunt.
Yeah. So, you know, what we do in the market demands a premium. We have, you know, very high service margins. You know, we've got a healthy business, and that's because we deliver a lot of value to our end users. What we do is technically very difficult. It's not easy to copy what we do. So then, you know, with that hardware enabled SaaS, from a business perspective, we have a really strong moat. It is very hard to do what we do. So, it is interesting because a lot of people, I think they go directly into software because they think that hardware is a race to the bottom. But if you find a way where you can do both, you can have a really powerful business because it is hard to do both at the same time.
When you go back to some of the early days, and I appreciate, you know, the company was on one track and there were some pivots and I'm a professional creeper here. How long have you been at about 11 years, almost 10, 11 years?
Yeah, it'll be 11 years in May. Yeah.
we're all getting older, Sean. We're all getting older. I saw that cringe in your eye that the audience didn't get to see. Like, Tyler, don't bring up the 11 years, man. It makes me sound old. Any challenges in the early, like, has that always been part of the model? Like, you speak about it so clearly now, and it's always easy to look at someone who's arrived and go, oh, it's so obvious why they were successful. If we go back a little bit and kind of rewind, get in the old time machine, that hardware enabled concept of like, this is actually going to be the best strategy for us because our objective was to save people in these environments. We had no choice but to have both, or was it always as clear cut and an obvious win business strategy as it sounds like now, X amount of years later?
Yeah, it was always, since I have been in the business, it's always been very clear. I'd say that clarity comes from two places. One, when I came into the business, Brendan had built a business that was selling these vehicle tracking devices, and that was
back to still devices, right? Devices. Yeah.
So I came into an environment where that was kind of already the place. So that's one piece. We sort of already had this model that we were working with when we decided to go into safety. And it makes sense. You know, when you're selling something that's cellularly connected, you have data costs, you have ongoing costs. And if you want to add value to the software, you need to find a way to monetize that over time. You can't just sort of sell hardware and then expect that hardware thing to fund your long-term software plan. So it's sort of a necessity when you're doing software. The other thing that really, I think, shaped my own passion for how I approached this business was that I mentioned Cody Slater, the CEO of our company, and he founded, he built the world's largest portable gas detection company before he was at Blackline. So there's a company called BW Technologies. They were the largest supplier in the world of portable gas detectors, and they were based in Calgary too. And I started working there in 2003 as an engineer. I was designing these gas detectors. And what I saw over time, company was eventually acquired by Honeywell. But what happened over time was the street price of these gas detectors kept dropping. They became commoditized. And what ended up happening was the factory eventually was shut down in Calgary and moved to Mexico and China.
Just to try to keep your cost down.
Exactly. And so that commoditization, that dropping of street price, moved an industry out of Calgary. So when I came to Blackline, when I worked at Honeywell, that was a real personal kind of mission of myself, was to try to keep that factory in Calgary. There's a lot of people whose jobs depended on it. And I think it was a very good way for young people, including myself, to really learn how to run a business, because we had this fully integrated business there. So when I came to Blackline, you know, it was really baked deeply into me that I was going to make sure that we could manufacture here. And the whole company's on board with that. That's not just a me thing. Everyone here buys into that. But to do that, you need to deliver value to your end customers. You need to hold your margins high enough that you can hold a manufacturing base here. And we also have a phenomenal operations team here. I mean, our cost of manufacture in Canada is on par with what we would be paying if we were manufacturing in China. I mean, that is, we have.
I appreciate it. These aren't just nice to haves. You still have to have a business case that makes sense, right?
Absolutely.
And you have to work hard to make that true.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Curious, and this is maybe just a random question. So much of, you know, I hear, you know, gas detection and like as a potential customer, meaning the wearer, like the user, not because I'm assuming there's a customer layer at the corporate level, then there's a person out in the field who has this piece of gear hanging from them.
Exactly.
Knowing you're collecting a lot of data, and we're in that world now where people are so sensitive around that, was there ever been an issue around just the story of like, hey, is this Big Brother? But is also Big Brother saving my life? Like, it just feels like there's a bit of a twofold. As long as the data that's being collected is making my life better, I'm okay with it. And a few years ago, I don't think people necessarily had the optics, or certainly the PR, the media campaigns around, oh my God, who owns your data? Where it's happening? Has that ever been something for you guys? Or has it always been so rooted in, no, we're actually saving your life first. The data has come second. It's a random question popped in my mind.
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, that's definitely been... You know, if I go back 10 years ago, and when I started, The company was 30 people, and I started working here as a product manager. And part of what I was doing was trying to sell our solutions at the same time to understand if we had product market fit with the new safety things we were building. And so I'd be out in front of customers. And you know, it was very, some of the things that were really hard conversations in the early days were, what is the cloud? Like, is it reliable? Can you send data to the cloud? How does this cloud work? And, you know, that's gone away now. So we don't have to talk about what
the
cloud is.
It wasn't that long ago. They were like, what do you mean the cloud? Like, what are you talking about? Like, we take it so second nature now, but it wasn't that many years ago that that was not the dialogue.
It's shifted quickly, really. But the privacy, you know, privacy's always been and should be. I mean, that absolutely needs to be something that people care about and think about. And so privacy has always been on our customers' minds, and we take it very seriously. We take the, you know, the security, the integrity, the privacy, the reliability, the integrity of our data extremely seriously. And so really early on here, what I realized was that I had to talk with clients about acceptable use policies. And so that's something that we worked with our clients on, was to say, look, as management, you're selecting this solution. You're trying to save lives. You're trying to make people feel more safe, not just be more safe. You're trying to make people feel more safe at work. And the people need to, there has to be a contract here. Like, it's not a written contract, but there has to be an agreement that the employees will use these devices. And yes, there is location data in the device, because if someone has an accident,
I need to be able to find you.
You need to know where they are. You can't do this without location data. But the management has to commit to use that data responsibly. And so, you know, we don't sell any of that data. Blackline will never sell our customers' data. That is not our business.
Because you're a steward of that data on behalf of the client, ultimately, at the end of the
day, right? Exactly. So we hold that, but we don't do anything. We don't sell it. We don't monetize it in other ways. We hold that for the client so that they can do valuable things with it. But we also tell management, you need to talk about an acceptable use policy within your business. And with a lot of the first clients I worked with, I said, you really need to stand by this, that if someone misuses this data, you need to consider terminating that person. And so that's still what we talk about. And I think it's a lot easier now. It's like, that wasn't a revolutionary concept. It's not a revolutionary concept now. It kind of was back then, but it was a really important one. So we had these acceptable use policies. I remember Husky in Calgary here is one of our first clients. They were very forward thinking in terms of their safety programs. They're a part of Synovus now, and they still are very forward thinking. It's a phenomenal company to work with. And they adopted that acceptable use policy. They said to their employees, we absolutely guarantee that management will never misuse this data. And that was a very powerful statement from them. And we saw the effect that that had. And so that's what we encourage all of our clients to do, is really to make sure that that commitment exists inside their company.
And, you know, keep in mind that conversation was very different 4, 5, 6, like not that long, 10 years ago. It was a completely different conversation than today, when it's still a little more front of mind and the average individual goes, hey, wait a second, should I, you know, I want to really dive down the product market fit sales relationship, but I also don't want to miss out on, we kind of skim by the 100 million. If I think of the last just 10 years, because we're picking a timeline, how lumpy was that? Or like, just talk to us a little bit of that scale. Cause like, it's so go, hey, we're there. High five. Awesome. Yes. Didn't happen by accident, and probably didn't happen all at once, happened slowly. Thinking about the journey of even 10 or 15 or kind of back from you first joining the organization, how did that look? Was it bumpy? Was it pretty? Can I look at the graph and go, yeah, okay, that's making sense that we were, you know, did you start forecasting that out a couple of years ago? Just talk to me a little bit for the people going, yeah, that's awesome, but how did you get there? Like, give me some of the, give us some nuggets.
Yeah. You know, there's this like saying in one of Jim Collins' books that the, you know, a successful business is like this merry-go-round. It's spinning with a lot of momentum, you know, it's moving, but you know, you kind of forget that it took a lot of hands on the side of that merry-go-round to get that thing spinning up. And we're no different. You know, I think the company was $2 million a year when I came into it, and you're building everything from scratch. Like, it's a daily grind for people that have never kind of, I guess, done.
When did it stop being a startup? I always joke about that. Is that a mindset, or is that a dollar number? Is that what is that actually?
No, that's so interesting, right? Because I think in some ways you have you go through periods of sort of funding, you know, where you're not sure, the budget's going to be hit. You know, your sales is like very rocky in the early days because you're dealing with a lot of like
bumpy, as they call it.
Exactly. Yeah. So like you're
AKA, kind of like, AKA unpredictable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Hard to build a spend budget when I can't plan my earn budget.
Yeah. So you definitely go through those phases, you know, so you have all these moments of where you don't really know what's going to happen. And, you know, of course in the early days, everything feels more chaotic because you're building everything all at the same time. You're building a product, you're building teams, you're building marketing techniques.
You're changing the engine while the plane is flying. It's,
absolutely.
I do use that one frequently because it seems to work.
Yeah, but it's a true story. I mean, it's like, if you think of it as a car, you're modifying every component of that car while you're trying to fly down the road. The rubber on the tire, the rims, the roof.
I just happened to get sucked into the NASCAR series. They still stop for 9.5 seconds. Like the car is not moving while they do all the change-ups. Like it's not just rolling by, which in a corporate environment, it never actually pulls in, let alone for 9.5. I think that's the opening line. A good, you know, NASCAR pit stop is 9.5 seconds, but it still stops, right? For that 9.5 seconds. Yeah. Companies, unfortunately, if you stop, you're going backwards.
No, it's true. You can't stop. And so I think that's like, I guess this is more maybe a statement for people that are starting their companies or thinking of starting a company. Like it is a grind. You will be working very hard. You will be working on everything. You're going to be context switching every 30 minutes. You're going to be completely switching gears. You might be looking at a electrical problem on a product in one 30-minute period, and then the next 30-minute period you're talking about how the messaging might be different in Brazil versus the Permian Basin in Texas. So you're all over the place, and you have to be good with that if you're going to lead the company and grow it.
I just, even looking again, creeping on your LinkedIn, connected safety portfolio, data science, customer and employee experience, client success. Like it, you know, and you were talking about even your role earlier, like I was doing sales so I could not only sell, but understand product market fit at the customer level. Like the need to have those different perspectives, no matter what phase you're at, whether you're going from 2 million to 3 or 50 to 80, it's still all true, right? It's just scales differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that's something that I bring to the table here. I think I've always been good at understanding complexity and looking at a system and understanding how the different parts fit together. And I think that's something that the company here does well. We are vertically integrated, so we have to understand how one piece affects the other piece. But, you know, absolutely, I've got, you know, revenue generation and all these different functions under my purview, and a lot of those I built out of necessity. You hit a point where you say, hey, we're going to onboard a lot of people in the next few years. Let's build a performance and learning team. And, you know, we go out and we find a great leader for that team and put a mission in place. And then that team kind of builds itself. And we have an incredible culture of learning here in Blackline. We have a great performance and learning team, but you know, we've just like built departments as we've gone along, just to, you know, satisfy the need of what we have to accomplish in the next year, next 2 years.
So talk to me a little bit about, so I'm at 20 million and I have a culture and I have a team that has a certain set of skills. I'm going to double that. I'm just going to pick double. How did culture adapt to that journey versus the fact that a $20 million team skill set and a $40 million team skill set, there's going to be different hard skills that are there. How did that skilling up, which sometimes requires new individuals or having other individuals rise up to feed that need, how did culture and like just raw skills and talent balance out? Did they shift equally? Did the culture stay consistent even when you brought new people on? Like, how did that journey change? Because you often hear, oh, remember the good old days? Remember when we were small? It was so fun. The other people, you're like, what are you talking about? It was chaos back then. I like this version better. How did those two things balance out in that journey for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, we definitely, it's less chaotic here now.
I didn't want to make that conclusion, but I was gathering. Sean, you speak very calmly and very controlled. So you certainly give a sense of calm, which I appreciate. It's a valuable trait in a leader.
Yeah. You sort of have to enjoy that. I think like the early days were so exciting because so much was changing and we were doing so much and we were innovating in so many different areas and we were bringing a new business model to the industry. But culture, it's interesting because I've worked in a number of different companies and culture comes from the top, but a culture also comes from what you're willing to accept. So if you have toxic people on your team, then that would drive your culture. If your CEO can be the best visionary in the world, but if you've got toxic people in your business, it'll erode it from the bottom and you'll have nothing. It'll destroy it. people say things like culture eats strategy for breakfast. So you could have the world's best business plan and you don't have the culture to support it, nothing's going to happen. So culture is absolutely crucial. And I think that, you know, you affect by the people you hire, you affect it by how you lead, but you also affect it by the people you remove from your business. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people talk about. But when you have a person that is toxic to work with, and everyone defines toxicity in a different way, but, you know, when they're eroding trust in the business, when they're trying to sabotage others, when they're building silos, when they're engaging in destructive politics in the office, we all know, we've all worked with somebody like this.
Just generally being shithead, Sean. I'm just going to be, I said it, you didn't, just to be clear.
you have to remove those people.
You know, we've all heard, seen the no asshole policies, and you know, sometimes like the damage that it can cause is catastrophic.
It's huge.
It truly is.
I'm 47 years old now. I've, you know, lived through this stuff. And I think a lot of people sort of look at it as a hypothesis, like, well, when I'm in charge, like, this is what I won't tolerate. And it really is true. One bad apple will spoil the bunch. And so, you know, getting back to the question about culture though, that really does come from the top here. Cody's an innovative guy. He's a risk taker. We don't flame people for making mistakes here. We are hard driving. We're trying to get to a quality output. We work together really well. But if someone makes a mistake along the way, we catch it, you know, we make sure that doesn't impact our customers as much as we possibly can. But it's, you know, you've got to have that trusting environment. When you're in an innovative environment, you have to have trust and you have to be willing to try new things. So that comes from the top. And then, you know, early on, we recognized the characteristics of people that thrived here. And those were people that were resilient. They were responsible. They were hard driving. They set goals. They were curious. You know, they were trying to find mastery in what they were doing. And so we all, you know, we had a really good cluster of people here in the early days. And I think we all recognized that. And that drove a lot of how we were hiring. And then the more mature we got, the more we sort of codified that. We didn't start to talk about corporate values until maybe three or four years ago.
Okay. Interesting.
We just had them. And then a lot of people in the company were saying, you know, we got to make sure we don't lose this magic. Like, what is it that makes BlackLine?
And as you grow and you bring on new people, that's, and I was in a keynote today, just talking about, you know, organizational culture. I'm like, you can put it up on the wall, but if I sit through a couple of your meetings, I'm going to have a pretty good idea what your culture is. I don't have to read what's on the wall, right?
Absolutely. Culture is the way you make decisions. It's how you prioritize things. So if as a company, you decide to prioritize profit over the customer experience, if you do that, if that comes from the top, then that's what your culture will become. If you prioritize adhering to process over doing what's actually right for your customer, you will end up with a bureaucratic environment. If you prioritize being right all the time over being creative and taking risks and sometimes failing, you will get people that will not change with the times. They will not take risks. They will not sacrifice for each other. So you really do have to understand how even things like process creation can affect culture. And you have to understand, you know, what types of bumps in the road are we going to experience over the next few years? And do we have the culture to survive those things? Because it's not process that makes you survive the bad times. It's the culture. It's who you have in the company. So you have to really understand how does that culture attract and retain people, and how will those people weather the storm?
How do you balance, and this is a tough one, it's a very conceptual question, balance the, like you said, it's also about who you take, it's who you put on the bus, but it's who you ask to get off the bus too. And you kind of touched on that. And you're right, that's not as fancy and it's a little harder and nobody likes to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But on that side of things, like, I guess the difference between like coaching someone up and seeing that they can get there, and that, yeah, hey, I came from another place and it was bureaucratic. Oh, wow. I have this operating model I didn't even realize, but they could be still very talented and very value, mm-hmm. high value to the organization, versus I see that this is just who you are. That's not wrong, but it's not who we are. So you're going to have to go. How do you balance that? Because it sounds great to say on a podcast, but in real life, it's tricky as hell.
It is tricky. And I don't have an equation for that yet. I don't, you know, how
as much as the engineer in you would like to have one, Sean.
Yeah.
Let me pull you out my people are weird calculator and I'll tell you what I think about that.
Yeah. Here's an Excel spreadsheet. Let's
figure out. Yeah, right. I got you.
No, I mean, I think that's just like, I think that's done by having wise, talented managers and talking about it and learning from each other. You know, you do have to talk about it because that's how you learn from each other.
Talking about it, not burying it. Yes. You can't fix the secret and all those jokes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, being open with where you've maybe had a miss, you know, when you aren't sure of something, like talking to a peer about it. And, you know, that even requires a lot of trust. Like, I think in a lot of cultures, like managers won't go to talk to a different person because then they might look weak. And so, you know, you really have to create that safety net where people can just talk about things without fear of judgment.
Well, I love it. Psychological safety. But you go back to just good old Patrick Lencioni. Trust is at the base of the pyramid. If you don't get trust, you don't get high performance. It's just they don't. Like one is the foundation for the other, period. I don't think it, you can overcomplicate that, but it is true over and over and over again.
That is absolutely true. Yeah, that is an absolute law.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a philosophy. It's not a concept. It's actually a law. Yeah. Thinking about, you know, okay, 100 million, that was October. You guys are clearly rocking it. From a market perspective, global reach, you've got the country, you've got the bandwidth. How's that revenue? Like, was it slowly, then all of a sudden, and not to map out a graph? If we had a graph, we could get the last 10 years. But now, is it easier to grow to 200 million from 100 than it was from 2 to 100? And maybe that's a weird question. Is it easier to go from 50 to 100 than it is to 100 to 150? Yeah, let's scale it up a little bit to make that question. Because 2 million to 50 million is a whole other bag of tricks, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to use the word easy in these things.
you can choose to not participate based on Tyler. Let's reframe the question.
Yeah.
No, challenges, difficulties. What do you see, I guess, when you look to the road ahead?
Yeah, the challenges are different. I mean, in the early days, what you're faced with is, you know, do we have product market fit? Do we understand the customer? Do we understand their willingness to pay? Do we know how to reach our clients? You know, some products you're selling $5,000 at a time and you're trying to support a business with a payroll of X million dollars. And so, like, how efficiently can you access those deals? If you're going after $5,000 at a time, you have to be very efficient how you chase that. If you're in, so, you know, you're dealing with all these different things when you're trying to design your company, and then you're trying things out, you're bringing new people in, and you're everything's an experiment. Like, does that team concept work? Do the boundaries of what they take in and transform the business make sense? Do we have the right people? Do we have the right mission? Like, is that the right message? Is that the right product? When you get to 100 million, that is all known. Now, look, we know our business model. The teams, we know how to hire people for each team.
Yeah.
We have most of our teams solidified. But now the challenge is really, when you operate at scale, every little tiny thing that didn't matter 5 years ago is a big flaming issue now. So now every little, you know, like rock in the system, you know, is a bigger deal. So
the pebble in your shoe is a boulder coming down the hill at you. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, something that I kind of talked about here a couple of years ago, was like, it's not the mountain in front of us that's the problem. It's the rock in our shoe. We can go up that mountain, no problem. We have a phenomenal team here, but it's going to be that rock in our shoe. That's what's going to slow you down. So you know, when you're at 100 million to grow to 150, it's sort of like more of this, it's how do you keep scaling it up, and how do you do it more efficiently than you did it before? So really a lot of what happens is that you're trying to find efficiencies more in what you're doing, and you're trying to hold the culture while you're trying to drive efficiency. And that probably is the largest top end challenge, is looking at these teams and saying, or looking at just what you're doing in a certain part of the process and saying, is there a better way to be doing that? Can we automate that? And how do we automate that, you know, while we just, you know, without adding a bunch of cost to the system, you know, to do that.
Is there a risk that innovation takes a backseat because execution, efficiency is workflow? You can still be innovative in those contexts, but in the way that you referred to it in the earlier days, we were innovating everything because we had to. We've now figured it out. We're now executing. Is it just about having those people? Because sometimes the people who are really good at executing aren't necessarily the bleeding edge innovators, and not to criticize or take away. Everyone has their way of doing it. How do you balance making sure that, because you need both and they both are valuable, but it's always a tug of war.
It really is. You know, it's kind of interesting. I was talking to somebody just last night about, you know, engineering teams, and something that I found a while ago was the people that are really great at starting projects are not necessarily the people that are great at finishing projects. And I think this is true in some cases in engineering, that it's really scary and risky sometimes to take the first step into building a new architecture for something that you're, so you're building a new piece of hardware. What's the architecture? How many microprocessors are you putting in this thing? How are you dividing this up? What are you using for an operating system? Those are sometimes scary architectural decisions for people. And sometimes the people that are really good at making those decisions aren't the best ones at closing off the last 5% of the project.
Okay.
Yeah. And so sometimes you switch. And then, so, and what I've seen in the business here is when you're starting a company, you need this sort of cowboy mentality. Like
a little more of a maverick approach or that willingness to kind of hang it all out there, right?
Yeah. People that thrive in chaos, people that are energized by chaos. And usually people that are energized in chaos are not good at getting a system to 100% order.
Ah, okay.
Because they, so like,
it's not even about the risk. It's not even who's comfortable with taking personal risk versus not. It's just how they even look at the pace or the frequency at which the project is operating at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so in some areas we brought in people that are, you know, a lot more process oriented, you know, as we've like stabilized the business model, and we don't need people that can create new business models. We sort of bring in, you know, really good operators.
The argument is sometimes you have to keep the mavericks or the cowboys out of the thing, right? Like you should stay away from this. Like you should just leave this alone over here. You know, that's also the small company who's scaling, and the CEO is that person and won't leave well enough alone. You know, there's so many jokes or parameters around that. There's no one size or one answer.
Absolutely. I think, you know, to date, we've been like a fast moving, rapidly changing, very innovative company. We need to stay that way. We know that we need to stay thinking in a lot of ways as a startup, like doing what's right for the customer, reacting.
Back to, when are you no longer a startup? But it sounds like culturally you still are.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like startups are entrepreneurial. And so, you know, I think when you say like, when you stop acting like a startup, it's like when you stop acting entrepreneurial, that's when the nails start going into the coffin. So when you stop listening to the customer, when you stop thinking about how to approach things in a new way. And I do think that's a real risk as companies grow, because things become more stable. And so people kind of normalize to the level of chaos, and then chaos then naturally becomes more comfortable or more uncomfortable. So that's not a, you know, it's kind of an interesting one, because I think that's kind of the next horizon for us culturally here. Okay. As we grow is to understand, you know, how do we keep this culture when we're 100, 200, 300, $500 million a year? You know, how do you make sure you keep that culture of listening to the customer and doing what's right when there's so many more systems and so many more people in the business?
It's exciting. It sounds overwhelmingly energizing at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, you know, you asked about what's different when you're small and when you're big. Like there's no shortage of challenges. My days are just as busy as they've always been, but I'm like looking at different things. We're all kind of solving different problems, you know, that's important to keep that drive, keep that hunger, you know, keep looking for something that you can do better. And don't ever think that you've made it. Don't ever think like, oh, we're good now, we can take our foot off the gas. Like,
stay hungry, keep bite off more you can chew, keep chewing, all those ones.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit, even yourself, as you know, a concept that I learned years ago, which I really love, was the concept of time span. Like the ability to look how far in the future, you know, typically goes up with leadership. You know, at the beginning, I can be a product expert, but I'm looking at the thing right in front of me. You know, talking about you going out, I see it as product market fit. I'm talking to customers, I'm doing sales, I'm going back and talking to the product team, I'm doing that. Versus now, I would imagine in your role, you're looking a little farther down downfield. You're looking way out across the horizon. How was that even for yourself? And if that's not true, please correct me. As a leader, growing from the, oh shit, I got my hands on the tools, to like, now I got to talk about what tools my team might need a year from now versus the tools that I can pick up a hammer and help them swing today.
Yeah. My focus is sort of always on both of those. I don't know what the right way to do this is. I think it's probably different in every business, but you know, I'm definitely in touch with a lot of different things that are happening on the front line of this business. It's probably more my nature. I like getting my hands dirty. I think that's probably a habit. And so maybe this is a post-decision rationalization, but
I like referring to it as a habit though. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's made me good at staying informed. And I think that makes me a reasonably good decision maker in the companies that I feel like I have.
Because you're not disconnected from it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that when management gets really disconnected from the front line of the business, they just start making bad decisions. And I don't think that's not that they're evil people. It's like you just, you can only make a decision if you have good data and good information.
I was gonna say, it's a good decision based on the information you have, but that information you have might be incomplete. But you're not treating it as complete, you're treating it as truth. That's the danger zone. Because then you make bad decisions very confidently.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. So I think being immersed in it, so you can, like, we still make decisions with our gut, and the gut is really a computer that acts on all sorts of random, seemingly disconnected pieces of information that you take in. So the more you can take in, like, the full color of that information, I think the more it makes you a better decision maker across the board. So, you know, that's definitely something I've done. It sounds like I'm getting off topic here, but my point with all of that is that I'm always working with short-term decisions, and I'm always looking at long-term decisions. And I look at the long-term based on what I'm seeing in the short-term. So what that means is, if I'm hearing that we have a certain type of problem and it's happening every single week, then I can say, all right, then there's a certain value in solving that problem. And it might take us 2 years to address that. That might be a 2-year product, but here's how I'm seeing this fit. And so I think that makes, I do point to that. I don't want to talk about me. I think that habit would make anybody, you know, a good long-term decision maker. There's a real interesting thing I read by Sergey Brin. He's, you know, one of the founders of Google. Mm-hmm. And he talks about architecture being the mastery of the smallest detail. And what was really cool was him talking about how this is a couple of years ago. I don't know if this is still current, but a couple of years ago when I read this, he was saying that the core of Google search engine was still running on microprocessors, and a lot of it was written in assembly code. And so you talk about architecture, and I think a lot of people that, like, are in business or architecture, they picture the building from the top down, you know, but it's like, you really do have to, at least in the tech world, you really do have to understand the small details and how they grow up. I don't think you can, like, ignore that. And so being in the details sometimes make you a better architect. And so I think having a long-term vision requires that tactical understanding of what's happening, you know, on the field today. So every day I'm thinking about, like, what do I have to do by the end of the day? What's this small detail? What's happening over here? But I'm also thinking about it now. How does that inform our 3-to-5-year plan? And, you know, do we have to do anything, you know, different?
Well, the advantage that you have of being versus an individual who's just focusing on the day-to-day, which is very important, you have that one eye on the horizon, one eye on the now. I like that. I'm working on today, but I'm thinking about tomorrow simultaneously, mm-hmm. which sometimes can be a challenge because it's almost two different, you know, concepts, mind skills, however, I don't even know how to define it, but they sometimes don't hang out together.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think, like, the future is so abstract. Like, today is, it's concrete, you know, here's a real problem I have to solve today. That's concrete. And sometimes moving that to abstract is something that people can struggle with, but the more you practice that, the easier it becomes. So I do think that this is not rocket science, right? If you work in a factory, people say, go down to the factory, go and see. I can't remember what the Japanese word in lean is. Maybe it's gamba, but it's like, go and see is what it means. And so if you're trying to solve a problem, don't do it from your office. Get down on the factory floor, walk around, see what people are doing, and then solve the problem. Don't try to do it without, you know, like, really immerse yourself in the data first.
There's so many good stories and case studies about problems that were solved, but no one was having it. Wow, man, we made this huge corporate change. It's amazing. But everyone's like, I don't even, like, what? I don't understand. This is not what we were actually, but I still, this thing still doesn't line up with this thing over here, but we solved this big initiative. And you're right. I appreciate it's not rocket science in terms of a concept, but it seems often we can struggle as organizations to execute on it. So there's still that gap there of, like, yeah, it's not a complex idea, but yet we still struggle sometimes. We get disconnected and our biases take over.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you read a business textbook and it seemingly has everything you need to know in there, but it all comes down to execution.
It's almost like there's a bunch of messy humans involved, Sean, and we get in the way of anyways, that's a whole other, I love being human and I love its messiness, but you're right. If it was just about read a business book, you pretty much should have it at that point, right? Because they're all kind of regurgitated versions of similar concepts, to be blunt.
Yeah. Devil's in the details.
Yeah, it is. And so for you, just staying, like, obviously, I can hear the excitement in the business, but just, you know, back to the personal side, are you constantly skilling up? Is this something where you're, you know, going and attending the next, a cool conference just to find out what's happening? Like, how much and how important is it for leaders also like yourself that, because the business can suck up all your time, like, in reality, but going out there and getting exposed and always, like you said, having enough of an understanding of what's going on so that you can be valuable in those conversations, how much time and energy and how much do you dedicate to that? Because it can get pushed to the side.
Yeah. You know, this is probably a bad habit, but
this is where Sean shares the truth.
I read a lot at home, so I don't do a lot of learning on company time, and I don't recommend this for people. Like you know, there's this sort of, I'm not saying that, you know, dedicate your whole life to work, but I'm a very curious person, and so I end up reading a lot just at home about a lot of different things. And I think for me, what I found is that when I read about a different industry, that seems to be the most powerful. Like I can think through most problems at work. I don't, frankly, I don't get stumped at a lot of things like that are straight line problems at work. But then you say, what am I missing out on? And I don't do a lot of formal, I haven't signed up in a course in 5 years, which again, that's probably a bad thing. I'm not saying
maybe not. There's so much information out there. If you're actively pursuing it and a bit of a consumer of lots of information, which I think maybe you and I share that, sometimes I'm like, I got to really find something to blow me away to go to a course, because I got access to so much stuff that's just filling me up. I'm filling my cup, if you will.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I still do a bit of I just hop on something at night. I'll Google something that I don't know about and I'll kind of go on.
I think it's called going down the rabbit hole.
yeah. That's definitely it. Yeah. It's probably No, I do a lot of that. And I think
just curious. I think that's kind of table stakes in any role, to be like, in the world we live in, it's changing so quickly that curious, and I'm a huge avid of curiosity, as you know, I've kind of built a bit of my brand on it. I can easily judge something and close that door. I can be curious and, sometimes be surprised with what I learn. And that's my own bias towards it, but I'm hearing a little bit of that coming back from you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. I think you got to be open, right? I mean, that's one of the five kind of key traits they talk about in people, is like, be open to new experience. And so go find something, go read something that you don't know about. And you might not find a use for that, but 5 years down the road, you might run into a problem where you say wow, this is actually exactly the same as this thing I read on this biological system or
that
whatever.
Conception, the ability to inspire around a concept and go, oh, why would you read about that? It's unrelated. It's but stuff and things, there's often, I think, getting too focused on your own knitting can lead to some limited perspectives.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's where people talk about diversity of thought, but your own diversity of thought is affected by how curious you are. So if you're not curious, then you will not have diversity of thought. And what means is then you can be wiped out by one issue. This is, the diversity of a species is determined by, or sorry, the survival of a species is determined by its genetic diversity. Can you survive?
If not, one virus can wipe out the whole bunch, right? 100%. Yeah.
Exactly. And the analog for that in a person is how open to change are you? How diverse is your thinking? How diverse is your behavior? How well can you adapt? And I think learning and being humble and curiosity are all very much related to our own adaptability and our diversity of thought. So it's hard to be curious if you're not curious, but I think it's addictive. I think once you start to become curious, it really is a bit of a drug, and you get more curious. But that's really helped me in my role here, because we've had so many interesting problems, and I haven't taken from, there's no business like ours. I can't look to any of my competitors and say, how did they solve this problem? I have to look to other industries. I have to look to completely different things.
That's a really powerful insight right there. If you, sometimes you look at the likes, it's other industries that are like, oh, I see how they solve the problem, and now I see how it's relevant. That conceptual ability, I think, is really key, especially as you grow. And I love what you said. I can't just look at my competitor, because you're also not trying to just run someone else's playbook either. That's how you make, your moat gets pretty small if that's all you're doing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's how you end up in the commoditization path. if you don't come up with your own value prop, if you don't come up with your own mission, if you're following somebody else's playbook, you are going to be in a race with the person you're copying. You will end up in a race to the bottom.
Well, you're deliberately putting yourself there, literally, by your actions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They see you as that annoying company who's just copying them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sean, it's so good to have a conversation with you. I appreciate the dialogue. We got some personal stuff. We opened the personal pages here a little bit, which is good, as well as, I think from the journey to 100 million could be broken down and blown apart in so many ways, but it is a group of people coming together to accomplish a thing that was hard, and it continues to be challenging, and to have some success around it. So I do, it is a group of messy humans coming together to accomplish great things.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what makes it fun.
Touche. What's the best way if someone wants to reach out? Are you a LinkedIn guy? There's a million ways. Smoke signals, carrier pigeons. What's the best way if someone wants to get a hold of you?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest. Yes. I'm on LinkedIn. If you put my name in, I don't know how many there of me there are on LinkedIn, but Sean Stinson, Blackline Safety.
You came up pretty quick. I found you pretty quick, but I'm sure we're connected by, you know, multiple people. That is this biggest small town ever we live in, which is I call Calgary/Western Canada.
Yeah. Especially to the tech community. It's a very tight tech community here.
Yeah, which I do. I still think we still have some small town superpowers, that ability to support each other and ability to collaborate. And there just seems to be a willingness here that I think is a little better. I'm going to stick. That's my story anyways. I do think we have a superpower here in Alberta that even as we grow, it's still holding together. And I think we need to protect that or be deliberate about it, I guess is a better way to say it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely.
Sean, thanks for coming on. Thanks for the chat. Enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting with you when you hit 200 million, maybe even before.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tyler. It was great to talk with you today.
My pleasure. Thanks.